Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Kalshi loses in court to Utah. Can Utahns still bet on prediction markets? Utah's wildfires are moving faster than firefighters can stop them. Here's why. This isn't Utah's hottest summer, so why does it feel like it? And Utah is going to score homes for wildfire risk. Here's what homeowners need to know. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. And in the early part of the program, we'll be talking with Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you for joining us. We've got Leah with us here. And data enterprise reporter Megan Banta is joining us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with Leah Larson. And I want to talk about wildfires, but let's start with heat. This is something we're all facing. Many of us facing the wildfires, unfortunately, but all of us are facing the heat. So the headline here, this isn't Utah's hottest summer, so why does it feel like it? This is a story which also appeared in the Openlands newsletter. Your first sentence here, the summer is really getting to me. I have a feeling I'm not alone. I'm with you, Leah, and I think most of our audience is as well. Tell us about your hot summer.
Yeah, and sorry I didn't greet you at the top. My Zoom was freezing up because my computer's overheating, so everything's overheating. Yeah, this summer... I don't know, man, like it just feels different. It's been so hot. And I kind of talk about in that newsletter about how I just, you know, I know this isn't true, but it felt this year that the heat was following me. Like every road trip I went in, I hit conditions, like whether it was in Colorado or California or even like Pennsylvania on the east side of the country, where these heat domes or these heat waves would just set in and just like make it absolutely miserable. So you can't do the usual summer activities that you want to do and be outside. It's just like you want to hole up in front of your AC and do absolutely nothing else. I don't know if you've been having the same experience.
Yeah.
I know it's a few degrees cooler up there in Cache Valley, but man, it's been rough.
It's been hot. Yeah, very, very hot. Now, you did take a trip to the Sonoran Desert, so I can't help you with that one. But
but even they were having unseasonably hot weather.
Oh, they were unusually hot, yeah. Now, it's uncomfortable. It makes everybody grumpy. It also is the number one weather-related cause of death, I think I read.
Yeah, he is definitely dangerous. You know, there's all these studies that do show that it takes a toll on our health. You know, like you can get heat exhaustion, you can die from being exposed to too much heat. But also, it's not just in my head. I mean, I guess it is just in my head, but it takes a mental toll. It makes people really irritable. It causes spurts and violence. Like, I didn't include this in the newsletter, but I was thinking as I was writing this, like a few years ago, I went up to the Uintas in July, like a lot of us do, because it's like one of the few places you can escape the heat. But the traffic up there is now just so crazy because we all have the same idea, right? And I actually saw people almost get into a fist fight over road rage because it was so hot. And I think it was just really messing with people. So yeah, it just takes all kinds of tolls on us. Like it's not imagined it's happening.
And then for an outdoors person, like I think you are, staying inside, that's got to be a little depressing.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us don't choose to live in Utah because we just like being indoors, right? Like we're in a beautiful state with all these outdoor recreation gems. So it's hard. I mean, I love to mountain bike personally in the summer. That's my favorite thing to do. But when the temperature is 90 degrees, like I mean, maybe some of you have more minerals than me and like can handle that, but I cannot do it. It's not even enjoyable. You know, I don't know, Tom, what do you do to cope in this heat?
Boy, well, I'm not an outdoors person, so that doesn't, but still,
but I mean,
all of those things
like going outside and pulling weeds, you know, you can't
right.
even do that.
You can't even do that. Yeah, exactly. And then when you are inside and you say you feel guilty every time you crank up the air conditioning, and I relate to that as well.
Oh, right. It's just a feedback loop, right? You know, like we all know by now that the Great Salt Lake is just not doing well. And it barely saw, you know, even a blip of spring runoff because we didn't get any snow. So you really shouldn't be watering. So, you know, I love to garden and it's just hard to look outside and see everything dying and struggling in the heat. And then it's like, well, do I crank on the water? Like, do I give them some relief or am I just compounding the problems? Same thing with AC. Like it is so, so hot. that, like, you know, that's kind of the only relief you can get. But you, when you crank it on, you know, you're putting a tax on the grid, you're contributing to climate change because a lot of our electricity still comes from fossil fuels, which is heat cooking the planet, you know. So it's just, I don't know, like, I don't have the answer or the solutions here. I just, you know, mostly wrote this newsletter to vent and like feel sorry for myself. But it seemed to resonate with a lot of people that, you know, I'm not the only one feeling this way.
Yes, certainly true. I mean, we're all going through this together, right? But you say, and this is something you investigate in the newsletter. I want to investigate this with you. Even though we're all feeling like it's the hottest summer ever, it meteorologically it isn't.
No, I mean, yes, weird, right? Like that even makes me feel like I'm going even more crazy. So yes, I spoke to the National Weather Service, one of their meteorologists. You can like pull all that data, and I think we looked at it from starting on June 1, which technically is still spring, but you know, just to compare to previous years. And I think, you know, if you look at Salt Lake City's data, which goes back to like the 1850s or the 1880s, it is not the hottest summer, believe it or not. It's like 10th. But then I was like, but wait, like peach tree that I love in my front yard. The first thing I did when I bought my house like 11 years ago was plant this peach tree. I saw its flowers come on so early. I knew that was going to be disastrous because a cold snap, I knew a cold snap would come and wipe them all out. And I was right. I mean, a lot of fruit farmers across the state experienced the same thing. So I was like, well, like, what if we look back to March 1st? Like, I can't be crazy. And so, sure enough, he pulled those numbers and compared this to like every year we have on record for more than a century. And yes, turns out this is the hottest year, maybe not the hottest summer, but the hottest year cumulatively. And then he was curious and just was like, what if we looked back till January 1 when the year started? Because as you know, we didn't have much of a winter. And anytime it did snow, including at elevation at the ski resorts, it would just immediately melt the next day. Yes, as of like January 1 even, this is the hottest year we've ever seen. So it isn't really all in our heads. It's happening. We're not crazy.
Well, that's good. I'm glad we're not crazy. Another thing that resonated with me, you said you find yourself grieving our lack of winter this year, and you talked to at least one other person who's feeling this as well.
Yes, like okay, I love winter because I love to ski. I love cozy days. I don't even mind shoveling snow that much. I love winter. I understand that not everybody feels that way. Totally get it. Cold can be tough too. Like I think, you know, you think of seasonal affective disorder, and that's mostly associated with the cold months. Although I feel like I'm increasingly feeling it in summer. But anyway, all that aside, yes, I had a reader reach out who does not love Utah's snowy winters that much, but she said that she finds herself grieving them too, actually. Like, I think we all know, like, if you've spent, you know, more than a few years in the state, you know, like, we are supposed to have winters. It's supposed to snow. It's kind of like a reset, sort of, where you know, maybe we don't love being holed up inside in winters, but it is that kind of time to like reset and like maybe focus internally and like look forward to the spring and the summer. But that's not happening. We like, at least this year it didn't happen. It was just like hot all the time. It feels odd.
You heard from at least one person who's considering moving north to get to a cooler climb.
You know what? I actually heard from a couple people who said that. I wasn't able to include everybody's comments, but yes, there are people who have lived here their whole lives practically. You know, they're like retirees in their 70s maybe, and they're seriously considering selling their homes and properties that they've loved and spent maybe many decades cultivating. You know, their kids and grandkids are still here, but they just can't take the heat anymore and the stress with all the drought and everything. So yeah, I mean, I guess they're a climate refugee of sorts because they're looking, you know, north or maybe to the northeast where it's a little cooler. Although I would contend that they are grappling with the same thing now too. Like we hear about heat waves hitting Seattle all the time, and like nobody has AC up there, so they're suffering. And like the Northeast is on fire, and they're dealing with wildfire smoke just like us. Like so, I don't know if there's anywhere to escape. It just kind of compounds that depression.
I was just talking to somebody last night who lives in Missoula, Montana. They were saying, yes, it's cooler than here, but we got a bunch of smoke. So it's trade-offs, yeah.
There's nothing more depressing than being socked in with smoke, you know, like, oh, it really is the worst.
So I think you did hear from some readers who, I guess I'll just ask you open-ended, are people connecting this to human-caused climate change, or what are they saying about that, the cause of the heat?
I mean, I think we've all, you know, there were climate deniers for years and years and years, but I think we've all mostly, I can't speak for everybody in the nation, of course, but I think we've all mostly accepted that climate change is happening. The science, like the people who understand this and have studied this for a long time, they know what's causing it. It's, you know, started with the Industrial Revolution when we started burning fossil fuels and putting all these pollutants and emissions into the air and creating this greenhouse effect. So, you know, we even have evidence that fossil fuel companies knew this and tried to bury it. So, yes, we know the cause, and yet we continue to burn them anyway. And I think that just compounds the frustration and the depression and the feeling of helplessness. And I did hear some feedback to that extent. You know, somebody who, you know, has just heard about even like heptofauna, which I think are lizards, like dying off in the deserts because they can't take the heat anymore. And they're adapted to heat, you know. That is just kind of depressing to think, right, that these actions that have caused climate change aren't just affecting the humans that caused it to begin with, like we're affecting many species. And it's just really altering the world. And, you know, who knows what things are going to look like in 10 or 50 years.
We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Let's move to another story here. I think we can put this one in. Utah's wildfires are moving faster than firefighters can stop them. Here's why. The experts in this story talked about a trifecta, in this case a bad trifecta, that we're experiencing this year.
Yeah, I'm bringing all the depressing stories this week, aren't I? I think, I don't know if any of your listeners have been following the wildfires closely like we have, and I'm sure they have. It is kind of weird to see like these huge fires pop up in the state. I think we all knew this was going to be a bad fire year, but it is kind of interesting to see them like set off and then like overnight they just like explode and become huge. And then as you read the updates day after day after day, it'll be like 5% contained. And like, that's crazy. They've been battling this for days. Why can't they contain it? And it's just like it's just the nature of these fires. They grow really big and there's not a lot humans can do to stay on top of them because of like the certain trifecta of conditions that line up that we can talk about. But I just think this is going to be the new normal, as you know, we were just talking about climate change and things getting hotter here. Just these big fires that explode overnight and are just really difficult to contain.
So talk about that. The fire triangle, I think it's quoted in your story.
Yes. Yeah, so these are the three conditions I was told by the experts, the fire experts, that lead to these fast moving fires that are very difficult to fight. So that those three factors are topography, fuels, and weather. So the first one being topography, fires spread faster on steep slopes, a lot faster than if they burn on flat ground. And I think we've seen that come to play this season. Like a lot of these big fires, like Cottonwood, Widemouth, they've been on steep mountainous or at least hilly terrain. And that's made them spread faster, makes them harder to fight because they are steep. There's like not usually roads and steep slopes. So that contributes. And then we have fuels. What is the fire consuming, right? So we just talked about, had virtually no snow over the winter. So every fire expert in the state knew that things were going to get bad because they had this vegetation, these trees, these shrubs had all this time, grasses, to dry out because there was no moisture. So that just turns into a tinder box. And then we have weather. That's partly the dry conditions, right, that we saw over the winter, but also, when it gets really windy, fires spread faster, and if it's really windy, aircraft can't fly and like drop, fire suppressants. So that contributes to it, makes dangerous conditions, so firefighters have to kind of pull back and they can't go in the attack as much. So those are the three factors, and it's just been like this perfect storm for us this season.
I was interested to learn in the story about a type of fuel that's been especially problematic, scrub oak. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was interesting. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting, too, because we got some data from the University of Utah that, like, use, like, satellites, I guess, and remote sensing things to look at all these areas that have burned in the state over the last 20 years and see which ones are the biggest. And they deliberately split that up between woodlands and forests. So yeah, the shrubs, firefighters are saying this year have contributed to a lot of these big, fast-moving fires, and they're specifically blaming gamble oak, which sometimes, like I call it scrub oak. I think everybody in the state mostly calls it scrub oak, but it's also called gamble oak. That has just like completely dried out, just completely become tinder. And like they were saying that if the leaves catch on fire and then they get blown up into the air, they can go land somewhere else and start a new fire. So that has been causing some problems for them a lot this summer.
So yeah, that statistics, Utah's top 10 years for woodland acres burned, this year is at the top.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say? Like, I don't think anyone's surprised. It sure feels that way. So if you're wondering, yeah, like this is a record-setting year for woodland fires. The Babylon Fire, the Cottonwood Fire, Babylon burned more than 107,000 acres. Most of that was woodland. Cottonwood burned more than 97,000 acres. Most of that was also woodland. So, like those were the top two biggest woodland fires in state history, and they both happened this year, and that is a ton of acreage to burn. So yeah, it's just a depressing year, like we said.
You talked to Darren McAvoy, who's associate professor of forestry at USU Extension, former hotshot firefighter himself. I just want to quote this and then have you tell me what else he said. He said that these fast, supercharged wildfires will pick up embers. They can be as big as my arm, he said, and then they go miles. So that's illustrating that firefighters just can't stay ahead of fires like this.
Like fire behavior is kind of fascinating and terrifying to me. And I just have so much respect and gratitude for people who willingly go out there to fight these things because they can just change on a dime and explode, like we've been saying. And like it's very scary and dangerous. But yeah, I mean, can you imagine an ember the size of your forearm just getting lifted up into the atmosphere like 1,000 feet and blowing 2 miles and just starting another fire? Like that's just, it's crazy to wrap your head around. But yeah, he says that happens. And then he was talking too about like if they're burning in a forest where the trees are quite tall, it just becomes so dangerous because it can spread up to the crown or like the treetops of the forest. And like those are usually 100 feet above your head, and that makes the flames burn like 200 feet above your head. So there's no way you're going to get a hose to blow water that high and put that, extinguish that flame. It just shows you how, like, I mean, it's amazing they can put these things out at all when you hear all these things.
Well, we're at the end of this segment. I'll just have people go read your story for some good news. Here's the headline: Utah produced more power from solar than any source in May, marking a new first. So that's good news, I guess.
Sometimes I write non-depressing stories
Right.
occasionally.
Typical of the media, I guess. We emphasize the negative, and we will have you go read the positive, though.
Yeah.
Leah Larson, water and land use reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
You bet.
When we come back from a break, which we'll go to next, here's the headline. We'll keep it with wildfires. Utah is going to score homes for wildfire risk. Here's what homeowners need to know. We'll be talking with Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune Data Enterprise reporter Megan Banta. Megan, thank you.
Morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So we're going to keep it with wildfires. In this case, how do you, I guess, in some cases, if you're in the wildland-urban interface, you can't even get insurance these days. And if you do, it's sky high. So State of Utah is trying to help. Here's the headline: Utah is going to score homes for wildfire risk. Here's what homeowners need to know. So what is the state trying to do?
Yeah, so we've had maps of like the wildland-urban interface that were set by cities and counties, but now the state has actually set one and is finishing up a program that'll kind of standardize the way that you look at homes for wildfire risk in hopes that, like, you can give your insurer the most information possible to, determine the actual risk. And then, hopefully either be able to get insurance that doesn't have a sky-high premium, be able to get it on the regular market at all for some people, or at least, kind of try to negotiate that premium down a little bit, even if you'd be paying more than you like.
So the state says they've taken thousands of homes out of they redrew the maps a bit to take a lot of homes out of that. So presumably, I guess you could get insurance or get it at a lower rate if you're not officially on the map.
So the idea is that, insurers have been classing homes as high risk, and the law made it so that if you aren't actually in the state's high risk map, your insurer can't categorize you as high risk. So yes, it should help, those 160,000 people who got removed, but doesn't necessarily mean that your insurance isn't still going to try to find a way to charge you more money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because their risk is pretty high if a fire should go in that area. So 160,000 people were taken off that, but that leaves 60,000 on the official map as being in the wildland urban interface.
60,000 parcels, a lot of them in, kind of in areas where you would expect, Summit County and Washington County, or areas around national forest land.
Yeah. Tell me about you talked to some homeowners who are in the wildland urban interface and tell me what they're doing.
So I chatted with Ryan Stefani, who lives in Mill Creek. He actually is no longer in the high risk area, even though he does back up, pretty much directly to Granger Peak. But then, I mean, obviously their insurance is still charging them a higher premium than normal because they are right there. I mean, there's a trail in their backyard that pretty much leads up to, like, the pipeline overlook that you could get to from Mill Creek Canyon. And they've kind of done what they can, just being where they are, there's inherent risk. But also chatted with a homeowner in American Fork who is nowhere near the wildland urban interface and is still thinking about it. Because, all it takes, like Leah was talking about, is some really strong wind, and those embers can move just about anywhere. He's thinking about it. Because he remembers, like, walking up a hill nearby and seeing, fires all around him a handful of years ago.
So Stefani put on a metal roof, right? Composite siding. He took out brush near the house. I guess those are some things that experts say, anyone ought to do if they're in these areas.
Yeah, essentially, you want to make sure your home has the right materials to be kind of, fire safe as much as possible. You want to create defensible space for, several yards outside your home, because all it takes is one ember getting in, and, your home could be gone.
So, under this House Bill 48, which is what we're talking about, the new state law, they've established a fee to cover new statewide assessments. You can get that fee waived or reduced, I guess, if you have somebody come out and inspect and determine that you have done some of these things to make your place safer.
So in the map that the state established, if you live within those boundaries and you don't get a risk assessment done to prove that you've done some things to mitigate, you automatically get classed at the highest risk level, even if you've done things. So he recommended, reach out to the state, get one of these assessments done. You're not going to get it lowered to nothing, but you won't be paying the highest fee, because it does help them, keep track of the map, keep track of, like, keep the assessments going, help train people on the assessments and things like that.
So again, insurers are not required to lower fees or even to give you insurance, but I guess the hope is maybe this will make it better.
Yeah, the hope is, that this gives people a fighting chance of protecting their home and not just, having to figure out what exactly they would be willing to lose in the case that they, don't have enough insurance and their home does burn down.
There's a website, UtahLivingWithFire.org. I guess that can give you some information.
Yeah, they've got a whole bunch of resources there. Told me they relaunched it, so it's something we've had before, but a lot of resources about how to how to create defensible space, link to the map to see if you live within the wildland urban interface, and a few other things like that.
So you talked with Jared Whitaker, who is with Levitt Group, as an insurance brokerage. Interesting to talk to an insurer. What did he say?
Yeah. I mean, so he talked about wildfire being and fire actually being one of the real reasons that insurance was created. But now obviously as there's higher risk and as insurers are assessing that, they try to take a pretty holistic look. Your defensible space is the biggest thing they'll look at, but it's not gonna be it won't be the only thing. And he essentially, he echoed the state in saying like an assessment could help. There's no guarantee, but did recommend that they get something like that done, that they talk with their agent, because I mean, the sense that I got from him was that agents are kind of willing to work with you, and if you can show them things that can help prove that you've lowered the risk for yourself and for them, they're willing to help you out.
Stefani again says that he realizes that the problems of living in that wildland urban interface, but he said the advantages for him outweigh the problems.
Yeah, I mean, so he and his partner are huge outdoorsy people, as are most people in Utah. I mean, I would love to be able to live in the benches if I could afford it, and would also accept that, at direct access to hiking trails and everything comes with this risk. And you kind of you weigh what you're willing to live with, and what you're willing to lose, basically.
We're talking with Megan Banta, who's data enterprise reporter for Salt Lake Tribune. I think we have time to fit this one in. Here's the headline: Is Utah the best state to live in, or one of the worst? Depends on who's asking. So, a couple of ratings came out, and Utah ranks high and low. How's that possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see this with a lot of things. It depends on what you're looking at. Like we're pretty often rated high by conservative legislative groups and groups looking at economy and like business opportunities, but not always ranked high for other things like air quality and like being friendly to women. So it really does depend on what they're weighing and what factors they're pulling into, this index that they use to score that all of the states the same.
And you talked to a state official who said he took exception with this negative rating. CNBC's, I guess, is the one that rates Utah low. But he says, well, people are voting with their feet. They're still coming here.
Phil Dean, who used to be in the state budget office, used to lead it and now is at the Gardner Policy Institute at the U, talked about a little bit of his hesitancy in not being able to recreate their index, because they say what they rate things on like overall, but they don't within that quality of life ranking then say how much air quality went into it or how much cost of living went into it. And it seems like it doesn't necessarily match how people are actually weighing some of those things, because we are still, we still get a lot of people moving here, and that's kind of what they call it, like a revealed preference, where CNBC can think one thing, but people are doing another.
U.S. News and World Report rated Utah highly. It's interesting. One of their factors that they rated is a young demographic, which they rated as a positive.
Yeah, so they're kind of looking at the same thing that CNBC was, but from just a different standpoint and looking more at the economic opportunity, the fact that companies know that they have like a growing workforce here and a young one, so that it's not it's not a retiree state. It's a state where companies know they can come and have people who can work for them for a couple decades.
Well, thank you for telling us about these two stories. Well, it's the time now for our underplayed stories of the week. Let's start with Leah Larson. What's your underplayed story?
Mine is by my colleague Brooke Larson, who's based in St. George, and she wrote about the newest inland port site, which is down there in Washington County. And what I thought was interesting about her angle, like I've written about a lot of these port sites popping up over the last few years, but this one I think is the first time a school board actually came forward in opposition, because what the Port Authority does is it t creates all these tax incentives to fuel industrial development, but that's funneling away a lot of money from school districts for a sizable amount of time. So I just think it's interesting that the school district took note and doesn't seem to be supportive of this. So good story by Brooke.
Yeah, well, thanks, sltrib.com for that one. Megan Banta, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, mine's by my teammate Addie Baird, who, and I think we all have some feelings about AI, and I don't think this got a ton of attention. Looking at the state's going to spend $5 million to see if AI can make Utah better.
All right, sltrib.com for that one as well. Well, in this part of the program, we've been talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you so much.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
You
Stay
too.
cool.
You too. Data Enterprise reporter Megan Bant has been with us. Megan, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Coming up following a break, we're going to turn to data columnist Andy Larson. And here's the headline: Kalshi loses in court to Utah. Can Utahns still bet on prediction markets? You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we're going to be talking about in this segment: Kalshi loses in court to Utah. Can Utahns still bet on prediction markets? And we bring in data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
So we've talked about Kalshi on this program before. So I think it's Kalshi that brought a suit in Utah, right? Trying to preemptively open the way or prevent action by Utah against them.
Yeah, and there was kind of a war of words that came about this winter involving Spencer Cox, Governor Spencer Cox, the Attorney General Derrick Brown, the legislature, and Kalshi and kind of its supporters, including Donald Trump Jr., who's a strategic advisor for the company, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, which is kind of a federal governing body, basically about whether or not Kalshi and prediction markets like it could operate in the state of Utah, or whether or not that was gambling. And in fact, Spencer Cox called it dangerous in terms of what it meant for Utahns. And there is a lot of research, by the way, that shows that, yeah, kind of this sports gambling, especially for youth, turns out to be damaging to mental health and kind of dangerous from both kind of a fiscal and personal standpoint. So this Kalshi filed suit in February, kind of seeking to preempt potential legal action from the state of Utah, preventing it from operating in the state. And then on Tuesday, Kalshi lost that suit, and Judge Robert Shelby was pretty strongly in favor of Utah being able to enforce its own anti-gambling laws with regards to Kalshi and other prediction markets like it.
So remind us how prediction markets work, and then tell us how Kalshi and the other markets, how they're saying that they're not gambling.
Yeah, so they allow people to trade what are called kind of prediction contracts, event contracts based on whether kind of specific events will happen. So that can run from sports outcomes, who will win the game, how many points are scored, et cetera, to the outcome of elections, primary or general, to even the day's weather, what the high temperature is going to be in a specific city at a specific time, kind of all over the map. Entertainment contracts, how much money a movie will make in a given weekend. And so basically they say that because these are contracts traded kind of speculatively, like stocks, that they belong under federal jurisdiction, whereas the state disagrees.
Now, the Utah legislature passed a law defining what gambling is, and state leaders feel like calcium and other markets fit in within that, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, obviously there was their gambling laws actually in the state constitution prohibits gambling, and then there are a number of laws in the books that kind of support that the constitutional amendment. But the HB 243 this session clarified that kind of these betting on quote unquote on an individual action, statistic, occurrence, or non-occurrence counts as what's called a proposition bet, and therefore is gambling. And so that is kind of one of the things at stake here is they wanted to kind of, the legislator wanted to make clear that, hey, gambling on an action or an occurrence counts as kind of gambling in the same way that roulette or craps would, you know?
So tell me a little bit more about Judge Shelby's ruling. This was totally in favor of Utah, I think.
Yeah, and it was not, you know, just a, hey, you know, we'll allow Utah to file suit against you, Kelsey, if you so choose. He comes out pretty strongly in favor of the state of Utah. I mean, he says in his ruling that, let me find the, it would be inconsistent for Congress to allow states to regulate their gambling laws, but simultaneously require states to provide citizens access to every event contract, including that those that constitute gambling under state law. So he's basically saying, yes, you know, like it would be silly if Congress, which has clearly given states the right to decide whether or not they have gambling in their states, to prevent this from being legislated by the states, as Utah has tried to do.
So now Utah is free to, it's been settled, they can take action to prevent calcium and other prediction markets from operating in Utah. Has the Attorney General said what he's going to do?
He is not, and is kind of leaving that up in the air right now. And he said, told Fox 13, for example, at this point of the game, we're simply looking at what our options are, and I would say that everything is on the table, quote unquote. I reached out to their office as well, did not get any kind of further clarification on what that might mean. Reached out to Kelsey, kind of asked them, hey, do you guys plan on continuing to operate in the state? Also got no response there. They have been geo-blocked in two states right now, and well, actually it's three, and then four are kind of on the way. There was one that actually just started on Wednesday. This seems like kind of a growing trend where Kelsey can't operate as freely as it would like in a growing number of states. Some gambling experts and an attorney in the space say that, you know, it could be even 10 or more by the time the year is out. So this is, you know, legislation that's ongoing in a lot of different locations right now. I've counted 17 different states that are kind of involved in legislation against Kelsey or prediction markets and whether or not they can regulate them.
It's a mixed bag, as you point out in your story. Michigan, I think, restricts sports, contract bets on sports events, but presumably other, you know, predictions could go forward. Yep. What are some of the other states doing?
Yeah, and Nevada is one that is basically banned Kelsey nearly entirely from operating in the state.
So that one I wanted to ask you about. Raised my eyebrows when I read that because Nevada famously is home to legalized gambling. They just don't want online gambling.
It's funny they answered so strongly, it seems, to the lobbyist of the American Gaming Association, kind of the traditional casinos and gambling access companies that obviously it represent a large part of their tax base and employment base and everything else. So yeah, it is kind of surprising to see Nevada fight strongly against Kelsey, but indeed they have. But yeah, this is, you know, a complicated space where, you know, there are in, for example, New Jersey, Tennessee, Arizona, Minnesota, judges have supported Kelsey on this matter and in fact issued injunctions preventing states from taking action. And in other states, Maryland, Ohio, New York, Wisconsin, Nevada, and now Utah, the courts have denied Kelsey that injunction and really kind of supported the states to support their own gambling laws and future. So really, I mean, this is now in a number of different circuit court of appeals, and ultimately, I think this ends up being decided by the Supreme Court in the years to come.
Now, these prediction markets are regulated by a kind of a different, unusual to me anyway, branch of the federal government. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's a Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So, in general, investors of all kinds can speculate on oil futures or,
Okay.
pork futures and so on. And this basically the CFTC under the Trump administration has kind of tried to expand what it is in control of, including these prediction markets. And like I said earlier, there's significant administrative support from the Trump administration on this. Donald J. Trump, or sorry, Donald Trump Jr. is a strategic advisor to Kalshi, was kind of hired by them in 2025 in that role. And they want this to be kind of, they want unfettered access to prediction markets across the country.
What are people saying? I imagine Governor Cox is pleased. What are others saying?
Yeah, a lot of kind of happy parties, especially in Utah politics, about this ruling this week. Governor Cox said prediction markets are gambling full stop. They are causing tremendous harm to countless American families. Senator John Curtis said the same thing. No matter how companies like Kalshi try to spin it, prediction markets operating as federally registered exchanges are subject to Utah's constitutional gambling ban. Gambling is gambling. Like I said earlier, the American Gaming Association, the entity that represents casinos and kind of the lobbying sphere, also said that the AGA applauds Governor Cox and Attorney General Derrick Brown for upholding Utah's laws and protecting its residents, which is, again, kind of a funny way that the Gaming Association is championing the Utah's anti-gambling laws. But yeah, kind of if the usual people who have come out and in very strongly against kind of Kalshi and prediction markets like it in the state. We're very happy to see Robert Shelby's ruling this week.
So again, as you said, this is likely going to end up at the Supreme Court because the different states are ruling different ways.
Yeah, correct. And you've got different circuit courts ruling and deciding on these cases as we speak. Yeah, this has really kind of evolved over the last 12 to 18 months, and more attorneys general from different states are getting involved. So yeah, that kind of everyone expects it, unless Congress were to act, and it doesn't seem like it's likely to go in that direction either. The Supreme Court will, in the end, have to decide whether the states or this federal body gets to decide what happens with Kalshi and prediction markets like it.
So right now, if I wanted to, I could go place a, what do you call it, a contract on Kalshi?
Yeah, you could, and so the state is not currently geo-blocked or fenced off in any way. Utahns can go on there, like residents of 47 other states, to place kind of predictions on what might happen with regards to sports or entertainment or weather or politics or you name it. It's kind of surprising the number of different things you can really bet on sites like Kalshi.
And I guess the next thing to look for is Attorney General Brown, what he's going to do with this.
And kind of the next thing would be to see if he seeks to get an injunction to stop Kalshi from operating in Utah while this gets worked out. Kalshi has appealed the decision already. They filed their appeal one day after this result. So yeah, this is, like I said, an ongoing legal battle. It will be interesting to see if Utah court and Judge Shelby or another court issues that injunction on the behalf of the state of Utah, so it does not if so Kalshi is not able to operate here.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Tom.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And our thanks to our guests previously in the program. We talked with water and land use reporter Leah Larson and data enterprise reporter Megan Banta, and of course, data columnist Andy Larson. Thanks to you for listening. Hope you'll be with me again next time.